Welcome our speaker tonight. It is Chuck from Friday Night Speakers Group in Lansdale.
Yeah. I'm Chuck. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chuck.
We really need this. My sobriety date's August 1st, 2005. And my home group is Friday Night Speakers in Lansdale. And this thing's kind of in my face. I don't like it. And it's a meeting just like this. You know, we meet on Friday night. We meet at 8:30. Meeting usually jumps off at about 8:43. And we like it like that. And I am an alcoholic. I suffer from what the big book describes as alcoholism. I have a mind that tells me it's a perfectly good idea to take a drink. Good day, bad day, homeless, job, you know, whatever the circumstances may be, I have a mind that would, you know, prior to the 12 steps, obviously, and it hasn't really happened since then, I have a mind that tells me a fairly good idea to take a drink. And it's not always like a thought that's like, it's not a calculated thought that says, hey, you know, we're going to get up this morning, we're going to ruin our life. Usually it just kind of happens. And then I have a body that once I put this stuff inside of me, I can't stop. And it's not like, you know, 6 months later when I'm sleeping on a bench at Temple University's train station that I say to myself, I can't stop drinking. Immediately when I put this, whatever the case may be, you plug your story in. I had a sponsor and he used to say, you know, you gotta read this book like a 4-year-old, you know, and he's like, plug your story in. Now, I'm an alcoholic. When the big book talks about alcoholism in relation to actual alcohol, I can relate to it. I got sober in Philadelphia in 2005, you know, in the midst of the first wave of fentanyl-laced heroin. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the rooms that I was in that never took a drink that were in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't really think any of that stuff matters. The fact of the matter is if you do what the big book describes or suggests, you do as you know, in relation to your heroin use, alcohol, glue sniffing, whatever shit they do nowadays, K2, I don't know. We had PCP and Oxycontin when I got sober. That was supposed to be funny, but whatever. So anyway. So, you know, this stuff will fix your problem in spite of whatever AA tells you because, you know, there's always been debates like, you know, whether or not non-alcoholics should be here, whether or not they water down the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that, like, you know, the big book and the 12 steps were inspired by God, for sure. And in spite of however you feel about the work and the results, it works. It's not for people who have won it. You gotta want it. You gotta do it for your kids. You gotta need it. I need this. It doesn't matter. The bottom line is if you experience the 12 steps, which is sitting down with a sponsor, reading through the book, following the directions, and starting to sponsor other alcoholics, you will experience freedom. In spite of however you feel about this shit being here on a Monday night, which isn't that cool if you're young. I didn't think it was cool. I got sober young. I thought there was way more cooler cowboyish stuff I could be doing. You know, like wearing ski masks and driving stolen cars. But unfortunately, I was at Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, on top of having a body that once I start to drink or take Xanax, or snort heroin, or pop pills, whatever, you know, you choose to slide in there. I can't stop. And then the third part of my illness is the fact that my soul's ill. Sick, hole in the soul, however people want to describe it. That at some point, this, you know, fundamental idea of God, that like 9 out of 10, I'll probably better, even 9.5 out of 10 people. I know like one atheist. I have met a lot of people on my journey, and I know one person that grew up in a household where God was denounced. You know what I mean? We all were raised with some sort of idea of morality, righteousness, things of that nature. And for whatever reason, myself, I can't speak for anybody else here, and I don't know if it's a result of like alcoholism or a tough upbringing or what, but at some point, the road split. God went over there and Charles went left, and I paid pretty heftily for those, for that time in my life. So I come from a normal household by today's standards. Some alcoholism in the picture. Mom and dad divorced when I was young. It was like Vietnam in my household in the midst of the divorce. And I have like these really vivid memories of my mother who's like this big and my father who's like this big. He was the culprit. She was the one holding the fort down. And like I can remember my father coming home drunk, and you know, he's just kind of like a when he's in his cuffs, it's just kind of like, if you don't like it, kiss my ass, and she wasn't having it that day, and I remember we had KFC, it was a glorious night in the house, KFC takeout, and we're like getting ready for bed. Dad stumbles in, and all of a sudden this like huge, the table's like bigger than that, made of wooden tile, goes flying in this man's lap, and you know, and that's what it was like. They're the things that I remember, and then I remember you know, blended household, the whole bullshit. If you grew up with step parents and family and things of that nature, and I started drinking when I was 11, not like as a result of anything that went on in my house or the things around me. And I believe an alcoholic was born. I didn't have like this overwhelming spiritual experience that people talk about. Like I felt like, you know, the mothership had landed, it was ready to take me home type shit. You know, I knew that when I began to drink, that all the stuff that I carried, I've been in trouble my whole life. And all the things that I carried around with me went out the door when I began to drink. And, I started getting loaded when I was 11. I stayed in trouble for the next, you know, decade and some change in my life. I've been everywhere there is to be. They kicked me out of the fifth grade. I went to a couple different high schools. I was in my first mental hospital progressions institute when I was like 13 or 14. I don't know what it's called now. It's like, in Fort Washington. I was there twice in the same summer, and, juvenile placements, probation weekends, everything you can imagine. Funny story, on my 18th birthday, I was doing community service. I don't even know what for, but I was doing community service, and I was helping. At this point, my mama gave me the boot, and I went to move out with my dad in Schwanksville. And I was doing community service with whatever fire department's next to Perkiomen Valley High School. And they're having like their little chicken barbecue, and I'm helping out, whatever. And I'm doing like my last 4 or 8 hours of community service. And I get it done, and it's like, you know, that was like a milestone at this point in my life. You know, most kids are going to like picking where they're going to college or getting scholarships for playing football. And here I am finishing my community service. And like that's a celebratory moment in my life. And I'm sitting on the chair, and my dad's like, what's up? And I'm like, I'm gonna go out later. He's like, you think that's a good idea? And I'm thinking, well, no, but I'm gonna go out anyway. And I went out with some friends, and, by 3:30 in the morning, I was being, taken into the Paulsburg, New Jersey Police Department. I don't even know where that is, for felony drug possession. And I remember them saying, you know, you're gonna have to call your father, because I was still technically 17. And I said, nah, man, just like take me to jail. I'm not calling this man at 4:30 in the morning. And they were like, you don't have a choice. And I'm like, you know, refusing. And I remember him picking me up and like riding home the whole way like this. He had a pickup truck, and my dad's like built like me, but he's like 6'2", and he's got hands like this. And I'm just like, and he was like infamous for the backhand. Like my whole life, I don't think he's ever hit me with the front of his hand. And, it was like the backhand with the ring on. And I knew that's what was coming. So I was like, I remember sleeping like this. Like I'd wake up and like look around it. And that's what my life was like. I got arrested every Thursday for a month when I was like 16. Started with a stolen car. My friends went to the Poconos, with a keg and probably all kinds of other, you know, dry goods. And I had a job, and I, you know, my mom was like, you gotta go to work. And I'm like, you know. So I stayed behind, and, I needed to go cop. So I borrowed one of their cars without permission. And I was bringing it back. I lived in North Wales at this time. I was bringing the car back after I was done. And the police were there waiting for me because I didn't let anybody know that I was taking this car. And I saw the police, and I kind of knew that they were probably there wondering where this car had went. So I hit the gas, but it was an 84 Buick. It didn't go anywhere. And I got to the top of the street. I just hopped out while I was in motion. And I had been drinking Mad Dog 2020 and driving the car. Like the radio was all like super loud. And I jump out of the car to run, and like the bottle slides down my leg, and like it was clanging down the street. And they're like, Neilman, don't even bother. And I'm like, shit. And I lean against a tree, and they're like, yo, you've been drinking. And I'm like, nah, it's my shampoo. I put my hair in the cop's face. And he's like, you're under arrest for unlawful use of a motor vehicle and drinking. And I said, well, fine, man, you UMFers are going to carry me to the car. And I kicked my shoes off and just like stood there. I'm not a midget, but I'm not Goliath either, but you know. I became dead weight, and they carried me to the car. They bounced my head off the roof of the car, and I was in the DUI center. This is my first DUI, one of many. And and I'm like 16 years old, and this might not make sense for younger people in here. Like, I have a son at home now, so it kind of hits home for me. So it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. If you're 16 and you get caught drinking and driving a stolen car, mommy's got to come get you. So they call my mother, and she comes in, and I'm like going through my act. I'm never like remorseful. I'm always like, these cops, whatever, like, you know, I'm just trying to have fun. And so she does whatever they have to do, the whole live scan thing, take your picture, dance, sing, song, you know, fingerprints, blueprints, you know, DNA, whatever. And then they're like, you can go ahead. And we get out, and she's giving me the third degree. Now, at this point, like, this kind of stuff was not abnormal at all. It wasn't like some surprise, like, oh, yeah, by the way, your son's in a stolen car drunk. And she's like, what the fuck? Can I get a day off? And, like, my mother always joked that she kept her ringer off at her office phone because Pembroke Middle School was calling, like, 3 times a day. You know, either I'm fighting the principal, stealing out of lockers, and I'm never guilty. So, anyway, we get out, and you know, she's like, we're going home. I can't believe you. And I'm like, I need some cigarettes. She's like, what? And my mom's like a firecracker. She's like, F you, blah, that cigarette. Like, I'm surprised I'm going to run you over with my car. You know, and what I did was, I guess it's funny to alcohol, because it's not that funny to think about now. I was like, either we're getting cigarettes or nobody's going anywhere. And she's like, looking at my screen. I climbed up on the top of the hood and laid on the top of the car. It was a dark green Ford Explorer. I climbed up the spare tire, laid on the roof of the car. That was my protest. And, I'm not sure if I got the cigarettes or not, but that's what it was like. And then the next week, I got into a melee out front of a friend's house, and, somebody got hit with a bottle. And we were pretty drunk at this point. So we went running, because it's normally what you do when somebody gets hit with a, you know, a thick piece of glass. And my friend's mom let us go through the house. She's like, go through the back door, you know, and we're like running and like obliterated drunk. And I look at my buddy and he's like bleeding like bad. His hand went through the window, hit the kid with the bottle. And he's like, I gotta go to the hospital. I was like, you're on your own. And he went to the hospital, and I made it back down to the bottom of, like, 9th Street in North Wales. There's a place we used to hang out. We used to call it the Bridge, and it was, like, this little creek, and there's 2 concrete pads on either side of Montgomery Avenue, and we used to hang there. And I figured it would be a good place to take a rest. Like, I was tired from running, and I laid down. It's, like, 10 o'clock on a Friday night. Now, we're in a small town, and there's, like, whole crazy thing just went on in front of my friend's house where, like, you know, somebody got hit with a bottle. And So I'm sleeping on the sidewalk because I was tired from running, and my friends come and find me, and they're like, they're kicking me, trying to wake me up, and they pull my cell phone out, call my sister. It was like old Nokia cell phone where you could change the faceplate if we got anybody that's in their 30s. My man. And they caught her, like, we don't know if he's dead or what, but you gotta come get him. And she's like, at the same time, the police are calling her, like, you need to find your brother before we do, and just please get him home. And her and her boyfriend come, and they're flopping me in the back of this SUV. I'm, like, drunk out of my mind. And the cop comes, and all I remember is the cop being like, just take him home. And I'm like, nah, mother effer. And I jump out of the car, and I'm like, I start to scream in the cop's face, threaten his children, tell him what I'm going to do in 10 years when they grow up, and all this crazy stuff. And they're just like, the cop's looking at me, he's like, boggled. He's like, and I know, like, he didn't say it, but he's like, I just told him to take you home. You know, and here I am fighting this dude, And they took me into the holding cell, and they beat me up a little bit, because I'm just like, I'm like a you're under arrest guy, and I'm like, not tonight, you know, and I'm trying my luck, man, you know, like, I've been through this before, what are you going to do, you know, and that's always how it was. It wasn't, I was like, all right, you're caught, you know, and I'm in the holding cell crying like a baby, because that's what tough guys do after they, you know, get their share. And I'm in the, like, boo-hoo and, like, loser crying. Not like, I'm scared I'm going to go to jail. Like, oh, I'm 20, I'm 16, and I'm already a total bum loser. My friends are doing God knows what out in the woods. And here I am, you know, in the corner of a holding cell smelling like Bacardi Limon and weed and all covered in grass stains crying. And they come in, and they're like, Mr. Nealman, you know, if we release you to your mother or your sister, you going to harm anybody or yourself? And I'm like, probably. And the cop's like, what the fuck? He's like, what's the matter with you? And I'm like, giving him the finger, through my shackles, you know. And they took me to Norristown State Hospital, and I stayed there for a week, and they let me out of there. And again, we're home, and I'm like, I'm gonna go out. My mom's like, you think that's a good idea? Just like my dad asked me on my 18th birthday, and I'm like, well, yeah, I knew it wasn't a good idea. and we were drinking out in the North Penn High School at the end of the parking lot, like a little ravine, and there's like bushes. I don't know if there still is, but there was however many years ago this was. So we're drinking booze before the football game, and I was a pretty crafty alcoholic. So what I used to do when I needed money, I used to sell beat bags of LSD to people at the high school football game. I would get a receipt from Weiss. I'll buy a pair of scissors and nail polish from Weiss, and I will paint the back of the receipt if anybody planning on going out and needs a way to hustle money. I don't know if people buy acid anymore. But and I'll paint the back of the receipt, and I would cut it up into squares, and I'll put them in aluminum foil, and I would go to the game, sell them. And I'm the kind of guy, like, what are you going to do? See me on Monday, beat me up like my friends are crazy. You know, I'm like, oh, the money's already spent. You know, I really didn't care. So that was like my scam from time to time. And so what happens is we all smell like booze, but we don't, because we're like probably eating food and things like that, smoking cigarettes, because we knew we're like young, 16, 17, walking to the football game smelling like a brewery wasn't a good idea, because town Menson police ain't got nothing better to do than harass kids. So we're walking through the gates, but my buddy, who's 21, is drinking, and he don't care about smelling. So they're like, you guys smell like you've been drinking. And we're all like, you know, we're like, nah, not us. And we're thinking, well, you just tell them it's you so they leave us alone. And it didn't go like that. And what they did was they grabbed us all. And I'm sure I was running my mouth because that's all I ever do. And they searched me, and they pulled out all these fake drugs. And I'm like, don't – and I said to them verbatim, don't get a hard on, boys. It's fake. And they were like, guess what, asshole? It's your lucky day. And I'm like – and I was like – my friend's like at the top of the bleachers, like looking down on where like the track is where you walk in, and I'm like, yeah, and they're all like it was such a loser moment. And they locked me up, man, and I you know, I still have a criminal record. That ain't the only time that happened. But anyway, and this stuff's cute. I tell the story, so I don't know if it helps me blend in with you guys. You know, but I'm supposed to qualify myself as an alcoholic. That don't make me an alcoholic, it makes me a loser. And a petty ass crook, you know, and it progressed from there. In 2004, I went to jail for a strong arm robbery out in Phoenixville, and I did what everybody does when they get in a jail cell. You know, the gates close, reality sets in, and you get a yarn necklace and a yarn cross necklace, and you go to drug and alcohol groups because you got to get paroled out of jail. And you go to NA or AA, your church, and all those things, and, you know, relapse prevention and worksheets and, you know, whatever else they do. I don't know what they do in, like, these fancy rehabs now, but that was, like, they were my rehabs. I've been to Miramont twice, once as a juvenile, once as an adult, and then slept in a bunch of jail cells. And, you know, I was in Chester County because the crime I committed was in Phoenixville. I couldn't even have got there if you paid me money at that point in my life. I don't know how I ended up there, but that's where I got arrested at. And it's funny because, like, I don't have time for that. But anyway, so I'm in Chester County. I do it, you know, whatever. Do my time. Go to Montgomery County because I'm on parole in Montgomery County from previous crime. Not anything cool, like a lot of retail thefts. Actually, one time I was in Montgomery Mall, and we did like an old school New York City like boost mission. Like we went in there and I swear to God, like on everything I love, this is really what happened. Went to the polo section in Macy's, put like three layers of clothes on and ran out our front door like Walter Payton. All right. Straight up. It was the summer. I had like a bubble goose coat on, bucket hats that matched the plaid shirt under the, I'm dead serious. Like I know they seen this from my buddy got caught. I got out. I'm like, they were like, stop. And I'm like, and I'm running. I threw all the clothes under the car. He gave me up a couple months later. But anyway, like, that's the kind of stuff I would go to jail for. Warrant for a retail theft case, you know, like, not anything cool. You know, the occasional felony drug charge or something because I had too much money and too much drugs in my pocket. And then DUIs. So I'm already like, I don't go home on bail or anything like that. Nobody gets me a lawyer because, like, it's worthless. This kid's not coming home. And I sit in Chester County Jail, and, you know, my parents did the most loving thing the parent or the loved one of an alcoholic could do. They didn't do anything. They didn't send me no money. They barely came to visit me. You know, they took my phone calls, and they loved me, but that's about all they did. And I left there. I went on work release in Montgomery County. And, like, any good alcoholic, like, I met a guy that worked at TGI Fridays in Montgomeryville. I'd always had jobs like a short order cook and stuff like that. So we were like chatting, and I guess he kind of got the wind of like I knew my way around the kitchen. He's like, you want a job? I'm like, well, yeah, I'm on work release and I don't have one. And And he would look out. I mean, he would take me to and from jail, give me some money, get my hair cut, things of that nature. And I had a really good thing going on. We worked the second into third shift job, like closing TGI Friday. So I didn't have to be back in the jail at like 3 a.m. And the third shift guards, like, knew my uncle because they're like Vietnam guys. So, like, I'd come in there with all kind of shit I'm not supposed to have. I used to be bringing like Jack Daniel's steaks in for my homies in the dorm, you know? No? Okay. But anyway, you guys didn't live. So I'm on work release, and as soon as I get away from the pack, I do what any good alcoholic does. I start getting loaded, and I get myself into some trouble. And what happens is my mom comes to see me working at Fridays on the weekend and brings the Inquirer magazine from the middle of the newspaper, which I don't even know if that's a thing anymore. But, you know, and in there was this article about Big Bob Beck, and that he was, like, in Frankfurt, saving lives. I don't know how they worded it. He was like a reformed biker, recovering whatever addict, and he had opened this like recovery house. And she's like, you might want to think about calling this place. Now, I had no options at this point. I've been kicked out of mom's house, been kicked out of dad's house. Every friend of the family that moved me in, even my crack smoking uncle on the west end of Norristown, asked me to leave. You know, there was no like, yeah, you can come back. Well, you're probably changed. And they're like, uh-uh. You take your Xerox copy box of shit. And we'll get you some food and drop you off on the train. You're not bringing your show over here. And I went to a recovery house, and the recovery house told me I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to live there. So that's what I did. They said you can go to NA or AA. And the reason I was going to AA was because I met this dude, Sam, in the recovery house, and we had mutual friends from jail. So we hit it off. Sam was like an older dude that just came home from state prison. He probably is a drug addict, but he was only in the house, so he had a home plan to get out of state prison. And we hit it off well. The dude that's in, down here, this is what a spiritual malady is. When people talk about it, for me, this is what I think about. Because everybody, like, adopts everybody else's cliche description of the spiritual malady. This is what my spiritual malady looks like. Cornfield Roy, they call him, is my roommate up in my four-man bedroom. And all the bunk beds are made out of 2x3s and drywall screws and plywood, okay, to begin with. There's rats, there's roaches. The place is real nice. And it's at Tarsdale Orthodox in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia. And there was numerous shootings within, like, 10 feet of my front door in daylight. And so I'm in here, and Cornfield Roy, like, the room's like two bunks, and then there's like this little thing. Cornfield Roy sleeps over there, right? Cornfield Roy, every night of the week, comes home and says, man, we just came from this meeting in Croydon. Man, I'm feeling great. Love recovery, the presence of God. And we're like, man, shut up, man. Like, I'm tired of hearing this guy. Like, shut up, nut. You know, but I want to hang out with Sam. Now, these are the things Sam was doing. Sam was coming home drunk, smelling like Hennessy, and sniffing cocaine on his bunk in the middle of the night. And I would be getting off the train, and he would be robbing local drug dealers. And he'd be running. One time, like, I seen him sprinting out of the cell phone store with cell phones, like that kind of stuff. And I'm like, I hang out with Sam. Okay, that's my spiritual malady, right? It doesn't. You're here as a direct result of your drug and alcohol use. Your whole life, since you were 11, you've been smoking blunts, drinking, and doing drugs and getting in trouble. And here you are, living in transitional housing, and you would think that I would hang out with the guy that seems to know God, and I want to hang out with the thug. And that's what I do, and that's why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So this whole, like, gift of desperation, and you gotta want it, crap, like, I'm not buying it, because I don't know if I wanted it. I wanted to stop having warrants out for my arrest. I wanted to stop sleeping outside. And asking people, yo, man, it's kind of cold, man, can I sleep in your car? And then being like, no. You know, those are the moments I didn't want to experience ever again. You know, but outside of that, to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and live some upright life, pay my bills on time and things of that nature, I wasn't looking for that. You know, and I came to AA because Sam was going to AA. And we came to AA because Sam had to sell 2 bags of crack outside of the deli that's on Frankfurt Avenue on the way to the meeting. That's the God's honest truth. I'm not saying this to be cute. We're saying this because I condone living in recovery houses and taking part in nefarious activities. I'm saying because this is my experience, right? I'm not the alcoholic that came in here, went to some meetings, got to the dance, shared, doubled up on my meetings, and my life put myself back together. If that's you, my hat's off to you, but it's not me. Now, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's glaring. As long as the day is long, I'm well aware that I have serious problems before I drink and use drugs. And then I drink and use drugs, and I got even bigger problems. I've been a disciplinary nightmare since I can remember. Always in trouble. And so I go to AA, because Sam's going to AA. And I get in there late. I leave early. I had a Boost Mobile, flip chirp phone, and like prepaid phone with the, you have to get the card. And I don't even know what I did, because it was like now. Like, you take a smartphone and be not bored anywhere. Like, this is like however many. There was no, like, you know, going on YouTube and watching videos. Like, it was like a nightmare to try and get on Facebook from one of them phones. It's like loading, type. It would kick you off. So I don't even know what I was doing. I was hanging under the L while they, everybody else was in AA. So I'm hanging with Sam one night, and Sam gets us in a pinch, if you will, and there's a handgun involved, and somebody that's having something taken from them that's not really looking to have it taken from them, if everybody's following me, police, this whole mess. And I have this, like, moment walking back to the train, and it's like your whole life just flashed before your eyes, and I'm, like, watching the loser reel. Here you go again. You know, and they've been telling me a couple times, they're like, you know, next time, Mr. Nealman, I was young, I was like in my early 20s. And they've been telling me, you know, Mr. Nealman, next time you violate the conditions of your release, we're sending, you're going to need a toothbrush, because we're going to send you up into the mountains, you know, no more little county jail stuff. And I'm watching this reel play over in my head. Because I've been through this 100 times. It's all good. Got out of the Devereux Foundation at Brandywine. I was a model citizen when I was like 14, 15 years old. They shipped me off campus to go to school because I did so well in school. It's a juvenile, like, halfway house program, inpatient thing out in the woods. Model citizen, get out in the 9 months, like, which is like the shortest anybody ever gets out. Everything's all good. Mom says, if you keep it together and don't drink and start acting up, I'll let you get a tattoo. I got this panther on my arm, 7th grade, 8th grade. You know what I'm saying? But it always blows up in my face, man. I don't plan on it to happen. I was the only kid in middle school with a tattoo, you know? That my mom, that's all she had. Medication, because that's what they did in the 90s. Medicated kids, they probably still do it. But then that's what they did. You need Ritalin. You know, you're angry. You need Pexol, Depakote. You know what I mean? And then they're like, they're not aware that I'm drinking, you know, at that point it was high-grade marijuana, which I'm compared to stuff they got now is probably nothing. You know, Dro, Kind Bud, I don't know what they have now. And drinking Mad Dog 20. Like, I wasn't drinking Michelob on the way to school. I was drinking fortified wine. Wine is not even made with grapes. And my mom, she didn't know. She just knew she had a crazy kid and didn't know what to do. So she's like, you're going out Friday night. I'm not going to see you for like 2 days. Take an extra dose of the Zoloft. And then I drink 3 bottles of Mad Dog 2020. I'm homicidal now. I'm trying to kill the police. You know what I mean? It's, you know, like, that's what it was like. And I lost my train of thought. But back to Sam. So Sam always gets me killed, and what I do is I say a prayer when I get back to the recovery house, and I was just like, God, you got to plug me in with these people, because I'm not coming in here and not asking for help. I'm not like, my name's Jim, I'm going to die if I don't get any help. Can you give me a job? Like, when I see that stuff, I'm like, man, like, you got it licked, man, because I had no clue. I wasn't doing nothing. Like, I would have died a really slow, painful death if it was left up to me. And I said that prayer, and those things started to happen. Man, I met my sponsor at that meeting. He didn't share anything profound. It was a big book meeting in the Greater Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You could still smoke in there, and it was like a corridor. It wasn't even like a room. It was like the width of these three tables and like 80 feet long. And it was just like Newports. Like, you could cut through the smoke with a knife. And I don't even know if the dude was in there. Nobody was like, it didn't look like it looked here. It was like rough. The L's flying by. People were like doing God knows what in the back, you know, and there's like homeless people washing in the bathroom. And I come outside and they introduce me to this guy. And this guy, when I met him, I remember thinking to myself, he's really sober and he's really happy about it. Now, I was in my first drug rehab, Miramont, when they had an adolescent unit in God knows what year. But I remember people came from NA. This is not a knock on NA. It's just where they came from. I don't participate in that. People came from NA and to do outside meetings. And I remember it was always like dudes that were like my dad's age, but they dressed like they were my age. And none of them ever looked happy. And I remember that moment. Like, I remember my middle name. I'm like, these dudes look suicidal. Okay? They're not like, ah, my father was killed in front of me. And, you drunk dope. I shot, spilled more dope out of the cooker than you ever shot. Like, shut up. You know? And I remember that, right? And then I remember meeting my friend Anthony out front of the Greater Northeast Group. And he was the same age as me. He was younger than me. But he was out there and he was sober and he was okay with it. And I remember that vividly. I don't remember anything else. I don't even know if I trusted my own mother at this point in my life. But I remember meeting him and he was happy. And I'm sitting up in my fancy bunk at 12 Steps Ahead on 2116 Orthodox Street. And we're solving the problems of the world. It's like me. I'm like in my 20s, like a 50-year-old guy with no teeth over there. There's like a whatever dude from Oklahoma over here. Like, and we're just trying to figure it all out. And I said, so-and-so's downstairs. And I said, I was thinking about asking that guy to be my sponsor because Sam almost got me killed. And I thought maybe it'd be a good time to pursue God. And I walked down. I did what every guy does when they're asking somebody to be their sponsor. I was thinking, shucking and jiving. And it's like asking a guy to be your Valentine. It's the best way I ever heard it be described. Nobody's ever like, I'm really going to die from alcoholism. Will you sponsor? Like, nobody in 12 years I've been doing it, 13 or whatever. I'm amassed horrible. Whatever, however long I've been doing it, nobody's looked me in my face and said that to me, ever. It's always like some beat around the bush. I know you're kind of busy. You got a lot going on. How you know that? I mean, you don't even know me. It's always like that. And that's what I gave him. And he said, absolutely. And he took me out front and he proceeded to, read through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and take me through the first three steps sitting right there. And, I pulled out this laundry list of people I was going to help. And he said, slow down. And, and he said, we do this under one condition and one condition only. I said, what's that? He said, you have to do what I show you for other people. Now I'm like kind of an outgoing guy. So I'm like, well, that's a given, man. I'm going to save the world. And I went through the 12 steps and through in a matter of, we'll say 90 days just to be safe and generous. I was through the 12 steps and starting to sponsor other alcoholics. There's probably more now. There was like 378 recovery houses in like a 2-block radius. There was no shortage of people to help. If you're in Alcoholics Anonymous in 2018 and your sponsor tells you it's time for you to go look for alcoholics to work with and you tell them you can't find any, you're a sad excuse of a human being. You know what I mean? It really is. Like, it's easy. Really easy. There's clubhouses, recovery houses everywhere. I know there's ones up here now. So what I did was sort of show up. There was a whole street of recovery houses. There was 3 or 5 men's houses, 2 women's houses, a Spanish heroin dealer and a crack dealer that lived on either side of the whole street. And everybody would be playing Pinochle together. It was Arcadia Street, right behind North Catholic High School. I swear, it was like nothing I've ever seen in my life. And everybody was like existing in harmony. They're like at a picnic table on the sidewalk playing Pinochle with the drug dealer. It was the most bizarre shit I've ever seen in my life. And that's where I hung out at. And we started to go to Big Book meetings there. And I would go straight from work. And I would show up at these places and I would read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with alcoholics. See, it's not difficult. I'm a pretty smart guy and I'm just a good BSer on top of that. So if you give me anything and give me 30 minutes with it, I'd be able to convince you that I'm some sort of an expert. But I am an expert on alcoholism, drug addiction, lying, cheating, stealing, manipulating, jails, institutions, death. I'm proficient in that language. So when I read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and I start to read through the doctor's opinion, see, this stuff comes alive for me. It's not like I don't have to think, whoa. I don't have to think when it talks about succumb to the desire as so many do. We pass through the well-known stages of a spree. I could tell you a million different times in my life that that's exactly what happened. That I set out to just go to work one day and make it home to my girlfriend and ended up in prison or strung out or not coming home or whatever the case may be. So when I started to sit with these guys and read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't much struggle. You know, if you tell yourself there's gonna be. I believe my life was on the line. That's what them people told me. You know, you need to lay your life on the line for the next alcohol, and that's what your sobriety depends on. And luckily, you know, the people that I had come in contact with when I actually got sober this time were armed with the facts about themselves, and that's what they were about. Sponsoring alcoholics, going to AA, carrying the message, and doing the deal. So I began to sponsor alcoholics. I had experienced a sense of ease and comfort like it talks about in the Big Book, in the doctor's opinion. It talks about the sense of ease and comfort that only ever comes from a few drinks. And what they're saying is, when I was 12 or 13 years old, hanging out in the dog park across from North Wales Elementary, drinking Mad Dog 2020 and smoking joints, that my divorced household, all my legal, mental, medication, psychological problems, all the therapists I've been seeing since 7, 8 years old, none of that stuff existed. I would drink that wine and smoke some weed and the rest of the world would just kind of dissipate. And that's what they're talking about. That feeling needs to be produced by the 12 steps. That's the result for the alcoholic. See, I don't do consequences. I don't care. I've slept all kind of places a human being shouldn't have to sleep. I've been in jail cells that are designed with, for three people, with six people. You know what I mean? Been so hungry in places that my knees were knocking, you know, and my, I felt like my stomach was coming out of my back. You know what I mean? Like, and none of that stuff matters. When it push comes to shove, that's all going out the window. The results are what matters for the alcohol. And, I went through the work, and, as a result of sponsoring alcoholics, I started to feel the ease and comfort that only ever came from taking a few drinks. I had my inventory, and, my home group was young people's. It was in graduate hospital still. And we go to the meeting, and it's like, we all used to go, all the kids that were in recovery houses in the ghetto used to go down there, and the way they got us there the first time was like, this dude Anthony Grasso was like, yo, you just want to go to a meeting downtown? We're like, nah, man, you know, we were comfortable where we were at. He's like, yo, the chicks got teeth down here. And we were all like, get in! I swear to God, that's how he got us. He's like, we'll buy you pizza. I'm like, alright, we're in. And I'm going to graduate hospital, and it was like this whole group of young people like had their shit together. They had cars, girlfriends, college educations, jobs. They were happy to be sober. They talked about the stuff I like to hear. And I'm there, my sponsor's there, and he's like, yo, you got the inventory? And I'm like, well, nah, it's at my house. And I used to ride the train back and forth to like the Fort Washington area. I worked for my brother-in-law, owned his own roofing company. And, you know, I would do like my little AA stuff on the train, take my book, read it, highlight it. And I said, you know, the bag I carry is back at the house. And he said, well, let's go back to your house. Now, we lived on literally total opposite ends. I lived near the Allegheny exit of 95 at this point, and he lived near, like, the Oregon Avenue exit of 76. Like, that's, we were, like, miles apart. It was Tuesday night. It was already, like, 10:30 at night. This meeting started, I think, at 8 or 8:30, and it was, like, you know, by the time you got there, it was, like, 9:30, and then we had to get back to my house. It was, like, 10:30. None of that stuff mattered to this guy. It wasn't like, I don't really got time, I gotta get up early, so we'll do a little bit of your inventory, and if we get it done, fine. If not, we'll work on it tomorrow. It was like, we're gonna go do this, and if we're up till 3 o'clock in the morning, we're up till 3 o'clock in the morning. And we sat down, and we did the inventory, and I had the same experience a lot of alcoholics in AA probably had. You know, we laughed, we may have cried. He said a lot of shit to me that was rather embarrassing. I learned a lot of things about myself that I'd rather not know. You know what I mean? But I also believe that I was set free. And I'm getting this out. So the next time the guy that rode up here with me gets on his phone, I'm going to throw it at his face. So now in the big book, it has promises. See, it's like, this is foolproof. Even though it was written in 1933, it still pertains to your story. Now, whether or not you believe it is your problem. But the fact of the matter is, whether you're an OG dope shooter that hangs under Kensington Avenue, or you're just a bar fly that can't stop drinking and ruining their life, the information in this book related to your problem and the way to fix it is like principle. It don't matter how you feel about it, it's the truth. So, I lost my train of thought with that. But anyway, okay, so we're back at it. So, they're gonna tell you what you're experiencing, they're gonna give you some directions on how to approach the problem, and then if you follow the directions, it's going to promise you some things are going to happen. Now, when we get to the point of inventory, what it talks about is, we do this, we're honest, and we walk away, and it says, I'm not a verbatim guy, I'm sure there's somebody in here that's going to want to correct me, because there's always one guy. But it talks about, we feel the nearness of our Creator, our fears seem to fall from us, we're able to look the world in the eye. Now, that was my experience. I went over the inventory with my sponsor. I walked him to get the night out bus. You know, and it's funny because like there was really no, like when they say, you know, lay your life on the line for the next alcoholic, this is like a computer geek dude, you know, and we like, in order for him to get home at this time of night, he had to catch a night out bus at Kensington and Clearfield at like 12:30 at night, which is like taking your life into your own hands for anybody that's not been there. You could have an Uzi, it's not be safe on that corner at midnight. And it didn't matter, you know. And so he got on the bus. I went home, and I followed the directions outlined in the big book. It says we take the book from the shelf, we open it up to the 12 steps, and we read over the first five proposals. We ask ourselves if we've omitted anything, you know. And it makes this analogy about building something. I'm a construction guy. I guess I should know what it says. But pretty much it's like we build them with cement or we build them with popsicle sticks, because this is the arch that we're supposed to walk to freedom. Now, I did that, and it says, if so, you know, take some time to thank God for a better relationship with him, and when you're ready to move forward, say this prayer. And I did that. It took the hour like I was supposed to. Now, I left out that, like, in first grade, they thought I was challenged, right? And I was so bad. And they sent me for all this testing because, like, they thought there was something wrong with me. And they come back and, like, the kid's a genius. And he's probably smarter than the teacher. And he's bored. And that was the worst thing anybody ever told me. And the reason I tell you that is because up to this point in my life, now that I'm in my 20s, living on the outskirts of Kensington, I'm from Montgomery County, know you, in a recovery house in a pretty rough neighborhood. I moved up to a sober house now. I'm sorry. Still in a rough neighborhood. And you would think, like, but still, up to this point, you can never tell me. I didn't follow directions because I knew better than you did. Because, see, when I was 6, 7 years old, they told me I was smarter than half of you fools anyway. So you couldn't tell me anything. So for the first time in my life, I was given directions. I followed the directions. And what I did was, after I took that hour, said the little prayer, meant absolutely nothing. If you're doing this stuff and you're doing certain things in the 12 steps and you don't have, like, this big white light experience that carries you out of your window and, like, it's okay. A lot of us had the same experience. What happened for me was, though, I woke up in the morning and I walked out of the house and I didn't live anywhere fancy. There was no grass in sight. Okay. And, but I felt what the big book started to describe as the principles, you know, or the promises, man. Like, I was able to hold my head up high. The crumb that was on that piece of paper wasn't the guy that was approaching everybody that he came in contact with that day. You know what I mean? That almost like I had been set free. And, you know, and it's been an ongoing process from there. I started to sponsor alcoholics, like, probably 5, 6 months over. I haven't stopped. You know, it fluctuates like the weather, you know what I mean? And, but all the time I've been here, you know, the one thing that, like, 98% of the time has stayed in line is the fact that I've been sponsored. And when I mean sponsored, like, actually in communication with the sponsor, accountable to a sponsor. Like, I meet dudes who are, like, a couple years sober, like, oh, you know, like, God directs my life. And I'm like, you're a fool. You know, like, still, I've been here 13 years. My life's pretty normal and good. And still to this day, not on a daily basis, because I'm not that big of a loser anymore. But, like, on a regular basis, I need to be on the phone telling somebody, like, all this stuff I don't feel like sharing with another human being. And that's one thing that's always been in line, is that I've showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to sponsor other alcoholics. And I've always, like, tried to stay in some semblance of what the 11 steps suggest is and grow spiritually. So I go through the steps with this sponsor that I told you about, and I had a really powerful experience. I mean, I had an experience that was sufficient enough to remove the obsession to drink and pop pills and use all kind of whatever, barbiturates and downers and shit to get through the day. Okay? So he picks up after like a year. When he had a year, he picked up. I started to go through the steps with another guy, and in the midst of all that, what I did was I met the love of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous at an AA function, and the last stop on Memorial Day, there was a dance going on. There was no seats at the table. She was like, "Can I sit here?" She told me on my lap. I said, "Hell yeah!" And we were madly in love. I'm sure there's, I see like two or three of y'all in here already. I told her I loved her before I knew her middle name. You know what I'm saying? Like, let me tell you your story for you. So anyway, So anyway, so I get a new sponsor. And it was all like a divine appointment, I believe. So this guy's taking me through the steps and we get tight. I think you should be tight with your sponsor. If you're not, something's wrong. You should become friends if you're doing this right. That's my honest opinion. I don't know how you could share that much, like, intimate information and embarrassing stuff with another human being and not become, like, almost family. So I'm hanging with this dude, Joe, and Joe was crazy as the day is long. Dave knows him. And Joe was like, he was there through it all. So I'm living this, like, Maury Povich episode with this girl that I met in AA. And, when I met her, I lived in the sober house. I was helping an alcoholic and he was like, couldn't stay sober. And so, "You want to move into this apartment?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Just have the rent at the beginning of the month." So that's what I did. And about a week after that, she came home to the recovery house smelling like Jose Cuervo and they kicked her out. And I thought, how dare they do that? So I moved her in the apartment with me. And, you could imagine how that went. And so anyway, when the spin cycle's done, she's pregnant. We're not sure who the father of the child is. And I was like a baby. I'm like in my early 20s. This is all going on. And you know, and Joe's there, and I thank God for Joe. And so I end up having to go get a paternity test, and Joe takes me for a paternity test, and and Joe's like, "We go to Dunkin' Donuts on Ridge Avenue before we go to this place. And, we go get breakfast sandwiches and coffee." And I put my money out. And he was like, Joe was like real cool. He was like, "Nah, motherfucker." He was like, "I'm treating. He said, because it's going to be the last sandwich you enjoy as a single man. You know what I mean? Like, he was like, he enjoyed so much digging at me. Joe was like in his 50s. You know what I mean? And he'd been telling me not to do certain things. And me, like the good alcoholic I am, did what I wanted to do. And here I was. And it was, you know, that, and that's kind of how it was. And the child was mine. And I could spend a whole another hour talking about that. But the spin cycle goes on. Stops again. I'm walking out of family court on a Monday morning to file an emergency petition to take custody of my son from his mother. Nothing that I'm proud of. I'm telling this story because I would hope that somebody's probably, not hope really, I hope nobody's been through that shit, but probably I'll be willing to bet that somebody's having a similar experience or getting ready to love birds. And my whole really comfortable AA world was flipped on its head. You know what I mean? Two-step AA. Show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. Sponsor alcoholics, travel the Eastern Seaboard, speaking at every podium from here to Massachusetts, sound real good, but when nobody's looking, my life looks nothing like what I talk about up here. That's what my life was for quite a few years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of the stuff I was aware of, the girls, the this, the that, like I had a nice sneaker collection, I like sneakers, but I had no driver's license. I was eligible to get one back. I was eligible in 2006 to get an interlock device and get my license back. I didn't get it back in 2009, but I had a lot of Air Maxes and Air Jordans, and that's what it was like for me. So I get custody of my son, and I moved in with my mom and dad because I was like in my early 20s, and I'm like, could I wing this on my own? I'm sure, but I've watched people try this before, and let's take some help, if we will. And I moved in with mom and dad, and I was like, I hate the term untreated alcoholic, you know what I mean? But I really was. Like, my alcoholism was running rampant. My son's emotional and psychological, state was probably more stable than mine was. I came moving into my family's home at 5 years sober like a freaking Tasmanian devil. And, your spin cycle goes on again. And I experienced all this, like, physical stuff. Like, the big book says we straighten out with God, then we straighten out mentally, then we straighten out physically. A lot of dudes, I only speak for guys, think that the physical part is shooting steroids in your ass, vaping, and doing the selfies on the squat rack at the gym. You know what I'm saying? And it's not. When they're talking about straightening out physically, they're talking about with the world around you, like your creditors, your mother and father, your neighbors, the people you work for. See, I worked like a slave, but I was a total a-hole. Like, that was my legacy on the job I was on for a couple of years. I never said you didn't work hard. I just said you were an a-hole. And that's not practicing these spiritual principles in all our affairs. The squat rack joke, I was there. You know what I'm saying? I got the good idea like 8 or 9 months sober that I want, you know, because I didn't even look at any girls. I've been in AA. I'm like, stay on the path. Then one day I'm like, they're noticing me. And I was like, you know, I had some chi-chi weight on. I had just come home from the county jail. And I was on welfare, even though I was making $700 a week cash roofing, right? So I started working out at the YMCA, because when you're on welfare, you could do that for $2 a visit. And then they give you a free membership. That might not be the case anymore. But so that's what I did. I'm on the treadmill, and I'll be doing roof tear-offs. Every day of the year, I'll be on the treadmill running miles on miles, and I'd have like a white t-shirt on, and we'll be turning black from the sweat from like, if anybody knows what recovery board is or fiber board is, from like ripping it off of houses. And it's like in your pores. And I don't even go get a shower. I'm just running. I'm like, yeah, spiritual malady workout. You know what I mean? Bam! And then all of a sudden, I'm like 195 pounds. I'm like, what's up? You know? And then I end up a Maury Povich. And so I got grounds for their squat rack joke. But anyway, so my life didn't straighten out physically, right? My life straightened out for the viewing public of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the real world was still a disaster. Not paying amends, even though I'm supervised by 3 counties at that point in my life. Nobody supervised me anymore. Praise be to God. But at that point in my life, Chester, Montgomery, and Philadelphia counties felt the need to make sure that my life stayed on a certain path. I wasn't paying them no money. You know, all this crazy stuff. And I got kicked in my face about 4 or 5 years sober by reality. And I found myself attending this meeting, and this guy was speaking, and I remember him telling a story, and he said what I wanted to hear, but he said it with tact, you know? It was like he knew how to say what I wanted to say, and I said, you know, man, like, I was talking to him in the meeting, I said, will you help me? And I might even ask him to sponsor me. I don't remember what the words are. You know, I got a long ride back to Philadelphia. Why don't we talk on the phone? And we get on the phone, and he starts doing fact-finding, if you will. If you sponsor alcoholics and you have for some time, you get on the phone, you ask them questions, you let them give their shoddy answers, and you kind of fish for the truth. If you're good at your job, if you're on your game, then the things you do. You don't believe nothing you hear from these people. So he's fact-finding, and we get to the question. He says, tell me about the situation with your son's mother and your son. Now, my son had been living with me already like a year or so, with my parents at this point. I don't live with my mom and dad anymore, but at that point, that's where we were living. And she laughing at. Still doing better than you. No, it's a joke. But anyway, he's fact-finding. And I said, woe is me. I'm raising this kid by myself. She's this, she's that. And he said, tell me about the amends you made to your son's mother. And it was like, aah! I'm like, what? And he's like, tell me about the amends you made to your son's mother. And I was like, what? I'm like, she was on drugs, named my kid after another guy, blah, 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 blah. And see, the people that were around me, everybody knew each other. So they were like, we feel like you not cutting her throat is probably like group grounds for amends. We're just going to call it even. And that's kind of how everybody felt about the situation. They didn't feel like any action needed to be taken to clear up the mess I made. He said, let me ask you a question. I said, well, what's that? He's like, how long were you sober when you met this girl? I was like, I don't know, 6-7 months sober. How long was she sober? I said, a couple weeks. He said, did she stay sober? I'm like, I don't think so. He's like, is she sober now? I'm like, meh. He said, where is she at? I said, this is where she's at. Does she have any other children? I said, yes. Where are they at? With the grandparents. He said, He said, so it's safe to assume that she probably wasn't done getting loaded. No. It's safe to assume that at this point in her life, she probably wasn't capable of taking care of the responsibility that you placed in her lap. Yeah, meaning a child and unprotected sex, if anybody's not keeping up here. And it was like, yo, it was like a chin shot, man. Bam! You know, my eyes were watering. He hit me hard. You know, I was like, and it was the first time anybody ever told me the truth. You know what I mean? And everybody was like, I was the young prodigal son coming up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and here come this older girl, took total advantage of me. Yeah, right. And this dude wasn't afraid to tell me the truth, and took me back through the 12 steps for the third time since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in big book studies with dudes that know the book better than everybody here put together. Okay? And I'm sitting in this car with this dude going line for line, page for page with a book that I could recite front to back. And, the reason I say that is because, like, there comes a point in time where, like, it says in the set aside prayer, you gotta learn to shut up. If I had it all figured out, I wouldn't have been driving a hoopty, living in my mom and dad's basement with my kid with me. Okay? I wouldn't even be in the predicament I was in if I knew better. Takes me through this 12 steps, sets me free. And what I start to experience is like some guidance that's not like, you should read page whatever and pray. Like, he actually had some insight on how I should be conducting my life. The thing with Alcoholics Anonymous is, like, when we read about sex conduct in the book, this can pertain to anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says we avoid hysterical advice. You gotta watch who you're talking to here. You forget that, you know, the society that we're in. We're like all scraping the bottom of the barrel here, trying to help each other out. You know what I mean? And it was nice. Like, I finally had a sponsor that had like a wife and a family and a successful business at home and wasn't like, you know, I had plenty of sponsors that knew the AA game very well, but they're full of shit. They like hustled pills on the side, were getting fraudulent social security checks, didn't have jobs, but they were like 57. You know what I mean? Like, no disrespect to anybody, but you know, this guy took me back through the 12 steps and he saved my life. 5-6 years sober. I hit a brick wall in Alcoholics Anonymous, and without this guy and going back through the 12 steps and experiencing some actual like adulthood, if you will, adulting, I don't know if I'd still be alive. And I'll tell you a cool story. When I was in my first rehab, I was with this dude. It was Christmas Eve. No, second rehab. It was Christmas Eve. I was in rehab because that's what winners do. Big thug, tough guys go to rehab on Christmas. And we're talking about with hard rocks like me. Talk about in rehab. Motor Street. You know what I'm saying? Front in Indiana. Dope stamps. Shootings. You know? And dude looks at me and he's like, why don't we talk about something positive? And I was like, what? This guy really just say that? And he's like, what are you going to do when you get out of here? And I'm like, I don't know. Because I didn't have an answer, man. I was like, I wasn't even like 20 yet, you know? And I've already been through the ringer. I didn't plan to make it to 18 when I was like 13. I didn't plan to make it to 21 when I was 18. I don't know how I made it this far. Only by the grace of God, man. I believe that in my heart. And he said, you know, what are you going to do when you get out of here? And I said, I don't know, man. I've been working for my brother-in-law, Rufin, and I was thinking, like, I kind of like it. Maybe he could, like, teach me the trade and I could, like, start my own business. And that actually happened last year. I had a job, a really good, well-paying job with benefits and a company truck, and it was so stressful. I was having, like, panic attacks, and one day I was like, this ain't worth it. And I quit a really good job that I probably could have retired on to go in business for myself. I had, like, $1,000 in a bank and a 99 Ford van with, like, 300,000 miles on it. And it was the most brazen shit I ever did in my life. My son still lives with me. I've been raising him since he was a year and a half old. He's almost 11. And so far it's been going good. And the money stuff means nothing to me. The cool thing is, like, is that moment, you know, that like, all the fear. Like, this is conversations to people that were around me for a long time are like, when are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? And I did it. And I don't know, man. Like, I live a really normal life today. I live in my own place. It's me and my son. Nobody can yell at me for anything except for my 11-year-old kid, which seems to happen more than I'd like. But you know, it's all good. Like, I have a bank account. I didn't get one until I was 7 years sober. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the God's honest. It's just embarrassing, man. I was 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous taking my check to a check cashing agency. That shit's a joke. You know, I mean, if that's you, there's a better way, man. And I got a driver's license, and the car's insured, registered, and it's all in my name. You know, there's nothing in there that I got to worry about if we get pulled over. And I just went on vacation, you know, and didn't get in any trouble on vacation. And I don't know, man. I have a good working relationship with my family. I have a good working relationship with the guys like that are around me in AA. Most days I make a pretty good boss. I don't think I try and just blend in and not be like the boss, which is even cooler. And I don't know. Like, it's available for everybody in here. Like, I got sober in a shithole clubhouse. And I don't know what they were talking about in there. But it wasn't nothing like the stuff that I've heard coming to this meeting for the 10, 12, some odd years that I've been coming here on and off. And if it can happen for me, it can happen to anybody. You know, there's a handful of dudes here I know personally that have experienced the 12 steps that would love nothing more than to spare their own time to sit down with you to show you what was so freely shown to us. You know, the guys that showed up in AA for me and the dudes that I hang with that are sober, like, they have better shit to do on a Tuesday night than be in some AA meeting in the middle of University City. You know what I'm saying? But they showed up. I don't show up here because I need here. If I don't do this, I'm going to die. I don't really subscribe to that bullshit. I come here because dudes came here that had something better to do. And if they didn't come here, then I don't know if I'd be alive. And it's kind of like a gift to be able to show up here. If you lived a life like I lived and then you live like I live today, you kind of want to share what's been so freely given. And it's really not difficult, man. That's all I have.